The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 8th of November, 2019. On the podcast today, Andrew Pollaea, CEO of Vast Resources, VAST, talks about their operational progress, funding and board changes. Also on the podcast, Richard Hullahan, CEO of Polarin Imaging, that's P-O-L-X, talks about the completion of patient enrollment for their Phase 3 clinical trials and the appointment of a Vice President of Commercialization. Plus, Andrew Knott, CEO of Savannah Petroleum, SAVP, discusses their Seven Energy transaction, which has progressed to a pre-agreed completion phase. And also, I have Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's Bitcoin, blockchain and cryptocurrency news. And as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. And if you receive an RNS via the app, free Vox Markets app, free to download, and you like its contents, don't be scared to hit that thumbs up button, all right? And if you do hit that thumbs up button, and it's one of the most popular RNSs, then it may feature on this podcast, giving it a bit more publicity, and also on the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andrew Pollaea, Chief Executive Officer of Vast Resources, VAST is ticker. Andrew, thanks for joining me.
Morning, Justin. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I should be looking at the chart of your share price. And it's been up and down. I mean, massive moves upwards. It's come down a little, consolidated a little bit, but up again. It's an exciting ride if you're a shareholder. I know that. And we'll talk about the reasons why it's moved a little bit in a bit. Before we do, Andrew, for people not familiar with Vast, just give them a brief summary as to what you're all about, please.
Certainly. Vast Resources is a multi-commodity, multi-jurisdiction mining company. We're based in Romania and in Zimbabwe. In Romania, focusing on polymetallic mines, including copper, gold, lead, zinc, and now molybdenum and silver. And in Zimbabwe, we've refocused our attention back into the diamond space. So we've been named as one of only four companies that will be mining diamonds in the near term, along with some of the majors in the world, working together with the Zimbabwe government, and most importantly, working together with the community.
Excellent stuff. Yes, cool. Well, let's start with Zimbabwe. Where are you at with that right now?
Right now, we've signed a joint venture with the community to mine an area in the Chiadzwa diamond fields in Marenge, which has historically is diamondiferous alluvial gold. Alluvial diamonds, not far from where they're exploiting at the moment with the ZCDC, the state-owned diamond company. And we're just awaiting the final signature to get our boots on the ground. Now that we've got funding in place, we expect to be a very near-term startup and start the bulk sampling, which is realistically quasi-production in an area that is known diamond fields with very good grades, and we're very excited about the prospect.
Yeah, yeah. You say near term, and I don't want to box you in a corner here because, sometimes there's always some delays somewhere on the line, but it's unforeseen. But what do you mean by near term?
Well, I mean, alluvial diamonds are in the bulk sampling phase, and realistically in alluvials you can't jork an alluvial diamond field. Yeah. And luckily there's been a long history now of what's been going on in the area, and we're in an area that's contiguous with where they've been mining in the past. Near term means it's basically you're on the ground and you're basically mining gravels anywhere between 5 and 30 meters deep. So it's not a difficult mining process. It's the the trick in recovery is actually finding the right area and going through the processes and extracting and cleaning and polishing and sorting and screening and utilizing the right equipment. And once you do that, you can actually see very near-term cash flow. So it's quite exciting. And near-term means that we've been preparing for this for almost a year now. So all of the long lead items are already, you know, ready. It's a matter of just finalizing civil works, getting the power, the water, the camp, the site establishment, finalizing the fences, complying with the KPC. But, you know, it could very well be, depending on the weather, because it is heading towards the rainy season, it could be anywhere between, you know, 4 and 6 months if we do our job properly and if Mother Nature doesn't interfere.
Yeah, exactly. There's always Mother Nature. Yeah. So Romania, let's take us through what's the operations, what's happening there, Andrew.
As you know, we did some placings over the course of the last 6 months to enable us to be prepared for this funding opportunity that's come our way, that we've, you know, the team's worked very hard and tirelessly to put into place. It's not ideal in the eyes of some, but you've got to put into context that, you know, getting funding for alluvial diamonds and getting funding in Romania, we had to put it together as a package to allow us to do both projects simultaneously. So that's why it's a little bit of a perceived high cost, but in the grand scheme of things, it's in the interest of shareholders to avoid long-term dilution. So that's the way we structured the finance the way we did. So the long lead items that were of concern for startup were the extra electricity, which the cable's been laid. Everything's ready for the transformer that was ordered in July. That will be delivered later this month in November. There's five of our technical staff currently in China. We plan on tweeting nice photos of equipment that's going to be prepared to be shipped to Romania. The work on the ground in the flotation plant's almost complete. It's ready to drop in. It's mostly the underground equipment that needs to still be shipped over from China, and we hope to be operational very shortly. And I'm not going to put a timeline on that, but you know, we are planning on getting into some sort of form of operation before the end of the year, and that's been the target. That's what we've been saying, and we're still sticking to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And take us into this funding. You say some people say it's not ideal. What's the structure of this funding, and how much is it?
It's a $15 million facility with a net proceeds of $13.5 million, of which around $8 million will be going towards the diamonds and the balance towards extinguishing historic debt to free the company up, to allowing us to... We have that facility with Mercuria, who is staying with us as an off-taker for the Baita project on the copper. We've also got an off-taker for the lead and the zinc there as well, separately. So that's all already in place. Contracts are already signed and, you know, ready for us to start delivering early in the new year. But it is a hybrid. It's a bond that is deemed to be a convertible bond, but redeemable in cash. And the way that we've structured and looked at the cash flows over the course of the next 6 to 12 months, we strongly believe that we'll be able to redeem that loan in cash. It's in tranches. It's in four separate tranches. One is just over $7 million, tranche one, which will get Baita completely into operation. Mm-hmm. It will pay back $1 million to Mercuria, which will then allow us another 12 to 13 months to repay them the balance. And on top of that, we're paying out the balance of what's owed to our former joint venture partners, where we had a loan in Zimbabwe as well. So the balance sheet that we cleaned out earlier this year, we took, I think it was just on $38 million of debt on the books in the companies. Now we're sitting at, you know, just over $4 million, $5 million of long term debt. So there's no longer pressure on the company to repay any of the historic debt. We're now in a position where the balance sheet is clean to enable us to do this funding. And we're now, in my eyes and in the eyes of the board and I believe shareholders as well, we're a completely different company to where we were 6 months ago. And we're fully funded to production on the two projects. So we're, you know, and as I said, they are near-term projects. Both of those projects will be in production within anywhere from within the next couple of months. And on the alluvials, once we get the signature from the ministry and the joint venture from the ZZDC, an MOA, because an MOA gives us the right to start working on there while we finalise the joint venture documents, you know, that can be operational within 6 months as well. So, you know, we're looking, and they're near-term cash generative, which means that we don't plan on going back to the market for any further funding unless there's something spectacular that comes up, and it's only for growth of the business. But at the moment, there's no plans to do so because we just want to focus on these two projects that are in our hands. We don't want to sit there and try and rapidly grow the business until we have our own cash generation to do so.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, and there's been a board change or two?
Yes, our long-term FD has stepped back a bit. He's now just a business director because of his depth of knowledge. We didn't want to let him go, although he tried to resign, but we said no. And our CFO that came on earlier this year, who's done a remarkable job, has now stepped in to the role of FD as well. So, you know, we're an evolving company, and the needs of the company will be changing over the course of the next couple of years as we get into production. We're no longer, you know, an explorer or a junior. We still have the target of, you know, heading towards being a mid-tier company in the very near term. And the two projects that we've got starting, we strongly believe will allow us to do so. Also, you know, with the changes in government in Romania, we believe that there'll be new opportunities there as well, working together with opening some of those old mines. The new Minister of Economy that was actually started work earlier this week, he is determined to restart the mining sector, and being the only company operational in Romania other than the state, it gives us a wonderful first mover advantage. So there's plenty of upside, plenty of opportunity. We're still working on, attracting a cornerstone investor to come in to grow the company further. That hasn't stopped. We have the opportunity on the finance facility we have to refinance out the remaining portion with the next 6 months. We haven't stopped doing that. And we've got 12 months to pay back what we borrow on the diamonds. And we believe that the cash flow generation will allow us to do so. So it's a little bit expensive. However, the company, we believe on a conservative basis, will be able to repay this loan in full. And that avoids dilution on two very, very strong cash yielding projects. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the board and the company is very excited about the future. So yeah. We believe we're in quite a unique position.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? Just in a quick summary, 3 points then. If someone's listening right now, like to stand on what you're doing, but are not yet following the story, convince them to hit that follow button on your page on Vox with those 3 bullet points then, Henry, if you could.
I might end up going over the 3 points, Justin, but we're a junior mining company that's highly undervalued in comparison to our market cap. And I know every AIM CEO will say the same thing, but if you take into account historical data in the diamond fields and you look at what Beitzer was producing historically, on a PE of 3 on the Zimbabwe and a PE of 5 in the near term of production, we should be sitting anywhere between, you know, 8 to 10 times where our market cap sits today. So if anybody's looking for a safe investment in the mining space, in the junior mining space, we believe strongly, and the directors are doing so, believe that Vast is definitely a worthwhile medium term investment and possibly a short term investment, because we believe a re-rate is coming soon.
Marvellous stuff, Andrew. Thanks for that, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Justin. Always a pleasure.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Richard Holohan, CEO of Polarin Imaging. That's POLX. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Good to be with you, Justin.
Now, you've announced a sort of mini milestone, which is nice to get there, because it was taking a while to get the last few patients in, but the completion of patient enrollment for clinical trials, and we'll discuss this in a bit more in depth, what it means. But as always, Richard, if someone's listening right now and never heard of Polarin Imaging, could you explain or summarize the company, please?
Yes. So, Justin, we are what the FDA considers to be a drug-device combination. And by that, we have a contrast agent that we use in a functional magnetic resonance imaging examination. And we have a device which polarizes the xenon prior to the clinical exam. So we're a drug-device combination. We serve the pulmonary medicine market. And so by that, we would say any of the diseases that have to do with pulmonary function, asthma, emphysema, COPD, cystic fibrosis, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, all of the ones that everyone knows, which today are simply not served by medical imaging to any great degree, leaving pulmonary docs to struggle with designing therapeutic programs and managing the progress of their patients.
Yeah, okay. And this enrollment was for, I said, phase three clinical trials. You need 80 patients. You've got those now and the data. So what's where are you at the moment? You've enrolled, have you tested all these patients so far? Now what's happening with the data there?
Yes, we are well and truly done with our phase three trial, which is just a great accomplishment for us. Trials are very complicated things, as anybody who does them knows. And we're just thrilled to be completed with ours. If you remember the structure of our trial, it is a non-inferiority trial versus another imaging technique. It happens to be a 40-year-old nuclear medicine technique that has been out there and was approved to market in the late 70s and is not widely used because it uses a radioactive contrast agent and because its image quality isn't that helpful to docs, but it exists and it is approved. So it is something that the regulators can say, if you can prove non-inferiority, then we will accept your case and then away we will go. Yeah. So we're done with that trial. If you remember, it was two indications. The one indication was the pre-surgical assessment of patients who are being evaluated for lung transplant, because in that case, the surgeons always want to choose the weaker of the two lungs to take first, even if they're doing a bilateral transplant, and they use a technology to do that. And in the other case, one of the pathways of cancer therapeutics in lung cancer is simply remodeling or reshaping the lung by removing a segment or a lobe. And in that case, the surgeons want to know that if they proceed as planned, what will the vital capacity of the patient be post the operation? So we were compared head to head in an imaging comparison between the two technologies. So the beauty of that from a readout point of view is we don't have controls, we don't have blind studies, we don't have anybody on placebos in this trial. So the outcome of our trial is prescribed. It's arithmetic. And if you remember from our RNS stream, we actually ran a pilot study of this trial before we ran the trial, which went fine. So we're expecting no surprises out of the analysis side of the trial.
Yeah, exactly. So, and this, you think now data readout is going to be, what, within 10 weeks? So just the other side of Christmas?
Yeah, yes, on the order of that.
Okay, that's good. And so you're quite confident here. Now, take us into this. There's a paragraph in the RNS that says this will form the basis of a pre-new drug application meeting with the FDA. Could you explain what that's about, please, a pre-NDA?
I can. So anyone submitting to the FDA has the right to request, prior to their new drug application submission, a pre-NDA meeting with the FDA. If you have any questions, if you think they have any questions, and of course, running up to an application, you're looking at a couple of years worth of meetings and written correspondence with the FDA. And like all correspondence in daily life, you could scan backwards through the complete set of those things and find an issue here or there where somebody answered one question but not another, or perhaps answered it in a way that wasn't completely explanatory. So you have the opportunity prior to making your submission to cast an eye backwards on that entire stream of communications and decide whether you'd like to clarify anything before you make your submission, because the submission is a big piece of work. And once it's on the table with them, it is your document, right?
Yeah, okay, so that makes sense. So essentially, it's like, I mean, in a simplified way, it's like, if I want to get planning permission for something, I want to apply for it, I should go into the planning officer first, he'll tell me how I fill out the planning, how I do it, ask him lots of questions, and then I do it to make sure I don't get anything wrong, because once it's submitted, that's it. Even a small inaccuracy or a mistake could mess the whole thing up, yeah?
I think if you look backwards at kind of our history, we have always kind of aggressively sought ways to de-risk this process, right? Yeah. Including the pilot study and the rest of those things. And I think the other thing to keep an eye on, of course, is that the regulatory process and the people that do it are a dynamic thing. They're people, and so our regulatory advisors have been watching what has been causing current submissions problems. Yeah. And almost without exceptions, the recent handful of failures in their written response from the FDA did not miss the opportunity of pointing out that the submitters had failed to request the pre-NDA meeting, in which some of the things that did not go well for them would have or could have been handled. So on that advice, we decided to take the extra step and time to make sure we got this squared up prior to actually doing the submission.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's like, you know, if I'm sitting an exam for something and I have the opportunity to sit down with the person who's setting the exam, then I should do it, really, you know, rather than not do it. So that's good. So and then you're hoping that will be what the process of the NDA submission will be in Q2 next year. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, we're again being a little bit conservative. The process is prescribed, and so by that I mean there are regulatory intervals which the FDA is granted under the law for how this request and response process goes. So we can't make the request until our readout is complete. Once we've made the request, they have 60 days to do it. Once it's happened, they have another 30 days or so to respond. So this all, once you set it in motion, it's prescribed in the time domain. So we're just we're taking that interval and just saying that's the amount of time compared to our prior timeline that this will be extended by. But we think the improvement in the risk profile of the submission increases.
Yeah, and the thing is, yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, the most unpredictable timescale in this process has been the patient enrollment, hasn't it? Because, like I said, you couldn't, you know, you try to nail it down, but you can't predict the lifestyles of patients and where they're going to be at. And now, from this point on, it's pretty much, like you say, prescribed. You can sort of say it's going to be this amount of time, pretty much, you know, more accurately.
Yes, that's quite true, and you can't know what's in the mind of patients until you try to enroll them in a trial, and it turned out that despite the best advice of institutions that do trials for a living, remember, we were one of 400 trials running in Duke University at the time we did this, so these are not inexpert people, and when we had asked going in what the rates would be for these things, and what patient responses would be to trying to be recruited into the trial, you probably couldn't have thrown a dart and got it more inverted. Everyone thought that the transplant patients would be exhausted in their clinical regimes and not participate very highly, whereas the resection patients were, it's just a therapeutic procedure, who would object to that? And in fact, the converse was true. Transplant patients were highly responsive to the trial, and the resection patients were busy, and the flow of the clinical procedure made it more difficult from a timing standpoint for people to work it into the pathway. So yes, it turned out slightly differently. It also turned out, in retrospect, if you remember, we added the third site late in the trial, and that turned out to have been very helpful and determinant to getting this over the finish line. So that turned out to be a good shot to call as well.
Okay. And just to put it in a perspective, we talked about this before, but once you get through this, hopefully successfully, and then you get the FDA approval, just on a commercialization point of view, you know, what's the potential here? If an investor is going to do some research, they go, okay, so what's the upside?
Yeah. So if you remember, or if you saw the published research by us, and there are a few out there. We're sticking to the models in those research documents. We've made no changes in our view about how this unfolds. But this, I think, our feeling is this very much goes down the track of the original introductions of CT and MR to medicine. They basically revolutionized medicine. And today, you can't walk in a hospital that doesn't have an MR machine, or more than one in many cases. And I think we see this being that same model rolling out to the high end of academic medicine to begin with, which is where discovery and refinement and clinical pathway development takes place, and then rolling down and out to smaller hospitals kind of around the world as we sort this all out.
Yeah, absolutely. And As far as utilizing sort of, you know, your tech within the machines there, what is it, you know, on a cost basis for the hospital? Is it viable for them? I mean, is it within their cost parameters to use your tech?
Yes, it fits very well. And so happily, because CT and MR have already happened, mm-hmm. hospitals, and particularly the radiology department of hospitals, where this equipment will be because it's associated and adjacent to an MR machine, this looks very familiar. I mean, this looks like upgrades and accessories to MR as they always have. And these institutions have spent the last 30 years doing capital budgeting for the acquisition of equipment in that space. And this fits neatly into their business model in a standard kind of way. Nothing new or different for them. In radiology, it's simply kind of a new service that hasn't existed. So a happy outcome for them. I think we see this as being pulled into market at some level. I don't expect to have to do a lot of pushing, to be honest.
Yeah, marvelous stuff. Okay, well, Richard, last thing. If someone likes the sound of what you're talking about here and the progress you're making at Polarian, but are not yet following the story, just give them three quick reasons in summary why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
I will. I think we're sticking to our three, and that is, this is a large unmet need in medicine. Pulmonary medicine was left behind with the introduction of CT and MR, and we're going to solve that problem. The business and the process have been de-risked to a great degree. This is benefiting from $50 million of research that's been poured into the technology, and we are at the point of commercialization across the board and its set of technologies. And finally, we are bringing non-invasive, quantitative, three-dimensional imaging to pulmonary medicine, and very happy to be doing it.
Marvelous stuff, Richard. Good to chat to you, and no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
I'll do. Thank you, Justin. Have a good day.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andrew Knott, Chief Executive Officer of Savannah Petroleum, SAVP is ticker there. Andrew, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Justin. Thank you.
Yeah, some positive news out and the share price reacting positively. Seven Energy transaction progresses to completion phase. This is very good news. We'll dig into what this means and the significance if people have missed it in a bit. Before we do, Andrew, just for people who are not maybe that familiar with Savannah Petroleum, just give them a brief summary as to what the business is about, please.
Yeah, Savannah is an AIM-listed oil and gas company with interest in two countries, Niger, which is in Central West Africa, and Nigeria, which is also in West Africa. The business combines, upon completion of the Seven Energy transaction, will combine a cash flow generative production business that supplies approximately 10% of power in Nigeria, and then with an exploration development business in Niger, which has proven to be very, very successful to date. And the good news about both businesses is we see very, very strong growth potential in both. So this morning's announcement is that we are very, very close now to completing the transaction, with all of the commercial CPs now essentially ticked off. The court hearing for the scheme being next week, which means shortly after that we will have the full completion. So it's really exciting news for us as a business, and it really will enable us to move forward, focus on the assets, and really start getting everything into growth mode.
Yeah, absolutely. We say next week is the court date, the 13th, and then you say a couple of days after that, and then you're quite positive that that'll, you know, be the final bit. Yeah,
absolutely. That's the once we've got the court over and done with, it's a couple of days of doing mechanics, and then we should be complete.
Okay, and for people not aware of the significance, what does this mean, Andrew, for the company in terms of money and potential going forward?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of potential going forward, over the course of 2019 to 2021, there's a forecast average of about $150 million of cash flow on a contracted basis associated with that business per annum at the asset level, which is expected to come through. So that's obviously pretty significant for a business of our size, given our current valuation. But most importantly, well, not most importantly, but also as importantly, The business itself has a lot of spare capacity. So if we work very, very hard to add new customers and add new gas to that business, there's very significant, at least strong marginal returns that we'd expect to make, and significant cash flow additions. And the fact that we will be an established business in Nigeria will also open us up to other business development opportunities we anticipate over time. But I think the key thing is that we will now have access to this cash flow stream, this contracted cash flow stream, and that's the purpose of doing the deal, and is very, very exciting as a result.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And where do you see Savannah Petroleum, Andrew, say, in you know, longer term, say, further than 12 months out here? Where do you see yourself going here?
Well, I think we're very well positioned in two countries and in the region in general. So the focus for the first 12 months is to stabilize the business in Nigeria, get it onto growth. The focus in Niger is to develop and start delivering cash flows from existing discoveries, and then just recommence exploration activity in that basin. So that's the initial focus for the next 12 months. That said, there will be growth opportunities that will come our way, particularly in Nigeria. So adding new gas customers, adding new upstream gas resource, which we expect to be very remunerative, which we will look at. And then we've previously talked about things like the marginal field round coming up in Nigeria, et cetera, et cetera. There'll be other, probably more liquids-focused opportunities that we will consider. But the core focus is stabilising and putting those two existing businesses onto into growth mode. And if we do that, everybody's going to be very, very happy, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. And you're currently valued at, you know, just obviously a bit north of 200 million here. So when do you expect this valuation to be in a few years' time?
I'm not sure I can give you that, but clearly I think what you can expect is that I expect us to deliver significant growth and to be able to stabilise the cash flow profile. And I think if we do that, then if you look at, for example, the consensus analyst NAVs that we have, et cetera, et cetera, it would imply that there's significant growth, that there's significant value creation potential within the shares.
Yeah, yeah. And this deal is, you know, has been going for a while. There's lots of hurdles to overcome. Do you feel right now you're right at the end of the tunnel here as far as this is concerned?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And maybe just to quantify that, I think the analysts typically have NAV. I think one of the analysts, for example, has an NAV for the business of between 80 and 90 pence a share. So even without the growth, I think there's still a lot of... there's a fair valuation discrepancy between where we're trading and where we can go.
Yeah, and it must be a sense of relief for you, though, because it's been a lot of hard work and long slog, isn't it?
I wouldn't say relief is the right word, because I don't think at no point have we not thought that this is going to happen. I think just it's a sense that we're able to move on to the next chapter, which is managing the business and putting it onto growth. As you're aware, since we announced the original deal, we made a lot of changes to increase the control that the business has over the assets and to increase our equity stakes in the assets. And that took a long time last year to do, but it was something that we really wanted to do. And then this year with the elections, there was a bit of a delay versus expectations in terms of getting the consent for the deal, for the revised deal terms. But once we've got that, it's been very much straightforward. And I don't really see... Nigeria is a very sophisticated oil and gas jurisdiction. It's been around since the 60s. Yeah. There's about 14% of the oil majors. So companies like Shell, Exxon, Chevron, Conoco's cash flows come, upstream cash flows, come from Nigeria. So we're not really worried about the jurisdictional risk per se. And actually we see it as a very big positive, because what you're seeing, very similar to what you've seen in the UK or the US, is as Nigeria gets, as production in Nigeria gets more mature, there's going to be more and more opportunities for independent oil and gas companies such as ourselves to come in and acquire assets from the major oil companies, which are perfectly good, but they're no longer core to those companies. And I expect that to be a significant source of value creation over the longer term. Yeah. Time frame, so not within the initial focus period, but thereafter. And I think we're very uniquely positioned. There's not a lot of other companies of our size, scale, and capability now sitting within that are actually active in country.
Yeah. And what I mean, relief. I mean, it's relief going from a focusing on the corporate side now, where you can sort of start moving towards the operational side and getting that geared up.
Yeah, and just growing the business. Yeah, I mean, that exactly. is the key message I want to give you. Like, the focus for us now is to move the business into growth mode.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, Andrew, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of what you're doing here, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay. I think the first reason is that we have two high-quality businesses with a clear strategy to deliver them growth, and we're backed by a very strong strong institutional shareholder base, which is relatively unique. Secondly, I would highlight the in the Nigerian business, the potential to add additional contracts, and I'm hopeful that we should be in a position to announce new contracts in the coming months, mm-hmm. or at least one new contract in the coming months. And the because it's installed capacity that we have, the economics on those contracts we would hope would be remunerative. Mm-hmm. And then in the Niger business, we are in a very unique position. We've not really talked about it, but we have well over 100 prospects that we'd like to, that we believe are worthy of consideration for drilling. We've drilled five wells. We've made five discoveries. We've said that we believe the economics to be in the region of $1 a barrel finding cost, $6 a barrel NPV. And we're in a position where we should be able to get those initial discoveries starting into production, but also just we want to get back to delivering that value creation through the exploration drill bit. So that's three really important aspects of our investment case anyway, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Andrew, good to chat to you. Like I say, lots going on now operationally, so no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and Justin, one thing I would say is that for those that are newer to the story, if you look at the annual report, pages 6 to 9 is my shareholder letter, and that goes through where we've been and where we hope to go in quite some detail, and I think that's a really good way for someone to sort of get up to speed on what we're thinking about as a business. And then, of course, on our Twitter, if people want to follow us on Twitter as well, we're able to post a lot of stuff which maybe isn't picked up in the more UK-focused press, which is which also shows what's happening and how we're developing as a business.
Yeah, that's at Savannah Petrol. Not petroleum, but petrol there. Marvellous stuff. Andrew, good to chat. You speak soon, fella.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman. He's a cryptocurrency trader. He's an author. I got the book right here. Glenn, it must be nice, actually. Was it the first book you've ever written?
It was. The Crypto Trader was the first and, who knows, possibly the last book I'll ever write.
But yeah, but do you know what? Yeah, because, you know, I've written blogs, I've done videos and all that stuff, but I've never actually had something you can actually have, hold in your hand and it looks, you know, quite slick. It's made properly. Properly made. It's a proper book, everyone. It's not a leaflet or email leaflet to get you into a mailing list. It's a proper book. Was it nice to hold it in your hand and think, wow?
It was. It felt special. It was published by a proper big publishing company, and it felt exciting. Whereas, as you say, particularly in the world of trading, pretty much every trader who tries to inveigle you into their subscription scheme or whatever it may be, they always have an ebook that they can send you for free. And you know how they have those pretend mock-ups that you get of a pretend cover, and they make it look 3D like it's an actual book, but you can see that it's just kind of a cartoon without any pages. Yeah. I scoff at those people, Justin. Scoffed.
Well, do you know what I was just saying? You said then it's probably the last ever book you read. I think your headstone should be your book, like a replica of your book, you know, in masonry stone, like that opened up at a certain page with charts on it, and just the crypto creator Glenn Goodman top left, you know, and then the dates of your birth and death, and then maybe chapter one at the top of the other side. So it's like a book, and then, you know, like an open book. That's a headstone. That'd be quite good, wouldn't it? I think.
Yeah. Here lies the crypto trader, and underneath, in the coffin with me, is all my ill-gotten gains. Kind of a big pile of gold. I'll transfer all my Bitcoin into gold, say.
Don't do that.
So it'll kind of be like a tomb. Like
digging up every half an hour. Be dug up every half an hour. So I was joking. I haven't got any money in here. Stop digging me up. Anyway, let's crack on with some stuff here, and with some stuff that's vaguely relevant. So the Bitcoin price, it's very sensible at the moment. Now, last time I said this, do you remember last time I said this? It dropped off a cliff. But I feel, I don't know what your thoughts are, but I feel the Bitcoin price is almost, you know, readying itself for a rally in some way, do you think?
It is. I mean, at this point in time, and once again, I have to put the disclaimer that by the time that people listen to this podcast, things may be very different.
That's it. Yeah, that happens.
But at the point in time where we're talking, yeah, I've been watching it closely for, what, more than a week, about a week and a half now, as it trades sideways in this tighter and tighter range. So volatility has been collapsing in the sense that it's moving in a tighter and tighter range and just kind of within about $100 range now, which is very low for by Bitcoin standards. And also the amount of trading, the volume has fallen significantly as well. Now, all of this stuff presages a big move. It's, you know, it's the same in pretty much everything, not just cryptocurrency. It's the same in all the financial markets. When volatility becomes very, very low and a price just moves along kind of sideways in a tight range, then you know that almost certainly there's going to be a big move as it kind of bursts out of that range. The problem is you never know whether that move will be upwards or downwards, and that's why as a trader as opposed to an investor, I can make money on either side. And you know, with past moves that we've talked about in the past where we've said, well, it might go up, it might go down, you know, as long as you know where the boundaries of the range are and you can draw little kind of parallel lines or lines to kind of show the outsides, the boundary of the range in which the price is oscillating, then once it does burst out of the range, whether it's up or down, I can go long or short and make money either way.
Ooh, and look at you.
I can do whatever.
So having said that, I'm looking at the chart right now, and I said, I don't know when you listen to the podcast, when it's going to be released, but it's sitting right on the 200-day moving average right now, and it's not done that for a while. It's sitting right on it. 9183 in dollar terms, in US dollar terms. 9193. Yeah, so this is a key level. I mean, obviously, you know, these levels aren't, you know, like a concrete floor. They're a bit like a bit of a trampoline, a soft floor, but I mean, it's on a critical level here. But what I'm liking is, the 50-day moving average is slowly turning around because it was down. The 200-day moving average is still up. So I think once that comes around, pretty much all the moving averages will be in the right direction. If it carries on this range for a while, which I think is quite bullish, you know, we're on the MACD, we're above the zero. We're just above 50, well, 55 on the
RSI.
So
you see this as bullish? That's interesting.
I see this as at the moment, you're right, either way. Depending on what news comes out, if it's good or bad for crypto. But some news has come out this week, isn't it? Even, do you know, every week pretty much, maybe I'm confirmation bias pretty much, but every week to me seems like there's been, I did a video yesterday, there's been some good news on blockchain or cryptocurrencies. Like, I mean, yesterday Turkey was saying that they're going to launch cryptocurrency in 2020. A lot of these countries, I think, with currencies that are, you know, knackered, like the lira, the Turkish lira, which is, you know, it's paid against the dollar all the time. That's the problem. Everything's priced in dollars, like oil and all the commodities. It's when it's getting hammered, they don't want to be paid the dollar. They don't want to be running on. So I think that they want a cryptocurrency. Maybe I see Bitcoin becoming the US dollar of crypto, you know, because it's the most dominant.
Bitcoin is massive in Turkey. It's massively popular there. Yeah. There was a report that came out just a few weeks ago which showed that Turkey, out of the whole of Europe, Turkey is the place where people are most interested in Bitcoin, where they most want to trade it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's because their currency is in the toilet.
Yeah.
And that kind of, another article by hedge fund legend Ray Dalio came out a couple of days ago, where once again he was, we talked about a previous article of his on a previous podcast, but in this one, again, he was coming up with arguments to show that money printing by central banks in the major countries is going to go crazy. It's probably going to go crazy. Next time there's a recession and they need to buoy up their economies, the only way that they'll be able to do that is by just printing endless amounts of dollars, endless amounts of pounds, endless amounts of euros. And that has got to be a good thing for relatively hard currencies like gold and like Bitcoin. Yeah. And so he's sort of looking ahead to that moment. And as you say, Turkey is a precursor because Turkey is a country where the currency has fallen off a cliff. Likewise, Venezuela. If you look at any countries where people don't have faith in their own currency, then Bitcoin suddenly becomes incredibly popular. And so we can kind of think, well, during the next recession, whenever that may be, that may well end up being the case for the major developed countries, because we know that governments or central banks, more likely than not, are going to be printing currency like Bilio.
Yeah, well, do you know what? It's unbelievable. It's, well, exactly. The big reserve currencies of the world are, you know, the dollar, pretty much the euro, the yen, the pound. Every central bank, pretty much, is going to be printing money. Interest rates are so low, they can't stimulate any other way. And that means, obviously, that they get weaker, that supply goes up. And the only thing that's an ante to this, like you say, harder assets like gold and Bitcoin. Now, the next halving is very significant in terms of the next halving, because the inflation rate of Bitcoin will be below 1.8% after the next halving. That's below 2%, the 2% inflation target for most central banks. And like I say, when you've got countries whose, you know, currencies are in the toilet, they've got to somehow, you know, let's be honest, Turkish lira is always going to be knackered now. It's always, they're not going to, you know, it doesn't matter what they do, knock decimal points off it, it's always going to be, you know, a weak currency. So they're going to try and do something else, and they see almost, you know, almost go towards Bitcoin or you know, have a cryptocurrency as a way out, almost, you know, as a rescue line. So, and I just, even, you know, news from China this week, I didn't even saw that, but China now is not going to ban Bitcoin mining. A while back, they were going to ban it. Now they're not. And it's odd this has come just after, you know, when President Xi has said they want to adopt a, you know, develop a cryptocurrency. All countries are doing it. And when you think of it, you can't really, if you're going to develop your own cryptocurrency, you can't really ban Bitcoin, because people will want to, you know, to exchange it with something if they're traveling around the world, if they're going anyway, you know, in another bit. And the most stable or the most powerful of all cryptocurrencies, the big dog, is Bitcoin. So you'll need that there almost, that is the gold standard, you know, pretty much.
I don't know how China is going to feel about it, though. I mean, the leaders haven't said too much about Bitcoin itself recently.
No, they said they're not going to ban it anymore. But they were going to ban it 6 months ago. They're going to ban Bitcoin mining. Now they said they're not. So that says a lot to me, coming off the back of the fact that they're going to develop their own. Because you realise it's almost like saying, "Oh, we're going to ban the dollar." But you realise, hang on, you can't, because there's a carry trade there. There's a lot of people buy and sell in gold, dollars and yuan, so you can't do that. So you can't ban Bitcoin if you're going to have adopt a cryptocurrency. You can't ban Bitcoin.
The Chinese can do what they want, you know, and they generally do. Well, and if they feel that
they've done
Bitcoin,
the right thing, though.
They feel Bitcoin's a bit like Hong Kong, in the sense that it's an area that is to some degree out of their control,
no,
and they
gold,
feel extremely uncomfortable with anything that's out of their control. So if they are able to ban Bitcoin in the future, because they feel, you know, that's the thing. Maybe they're just not doing a full ban at the moment because they don't see it as too much of a threat right now. But
yeah,
in
think
the future,
about this,
they
though.
Might change their mind, is what I'm
think
saying.
Think about this, though. Think of it in terms of gold, and it makes sense, right? So, if you think of it, what's China like with gold? They basically start buying it. They basically start buying it up. That's what they do. And, you know, there's a liquid market for Bitcoin. They just start buying it up. It's fine. They realise, we've got the biggest miners over here. Let's just start buying it up. We'll pay our miners to buy it up. We'll hold the major supply of Bitcoin. Full stop.
Well, they do. I mean, China is where all the major miners are based anyway. It's like, it's in a sense, the Chinese government already could, if it wanted, control almost the entire Bitcoin mining supply.
I just find that somewhere funny. I don't know why. I find it a Chinese guy just smoking a fag in a massive, you know, a warehouse as far as the eye can see to the horizon, with just full of these ant miners, you know, just really whirring away, and then just smoking unhealthily, and just earning Bitcoin. That's what you do for a living, is it? Yeah, pretty much. Just check on the computers. It's a lot nicer than mining in real life, I suppose.
They're just like massive air-conditioned warehouses, basically. Yeah. And then, in fact, most of them are not anymore in China, I don't think, even though the operations that kind of run them are tied to China. So as I say, that's why the Chinese government might be able to take control theoretically. But the actual places tend to be in cold countries, places like Iceland, where they can where they don't have to pay so much for the air conditioning to keep these massive warehouses filled with computers cool.
That's what, if I was the government of Iceland, I'd just provide massive, or the coldest places in the world. Hang on, Glenn. What do you mean you're going to set up a business in Antarctica? We just need to get... There's never any cloud in the sky there, so you just get the electricity from solar, right?
Yeah.
And just give people incentives. Who owns the Antarctica? Who owns that?
I've forgotten. It's the international territory, isn't it? So
I think we
could just go there and just set something up. Nobody's going to come and evict us, are they, from Antarctica? Seems very unlikely.
But if I was from, like, you know, Iceland or one of the coldest planets in the world, I mean, where there's very little industry because it's so cold, like Siberia, you just give offer open incentives, wouldn't you? Say if you come mine cryptocurrencies here, you know, we'll give you this incentive, this will help you. And you'd have the world come into you to mine, you know, just all you need is an internet connection.
It's true.
A bit more than that.
It's like, even if they've run out of natural resources, they've run out of coal, but then they're like, oh, actually, here's a new natural resource that we can encourage people to mine. So suddenly you have a raison d'etre for Siberia all over again.
Yeah, Antarctica is not a country, of course. I say, of course.
you've just Googled that.
Yeah, this off the top of my head. While it just comes to me, while no one officially owns Antarctica, over 12 countries claim to have rights to at least a portion of it. These include France, Australia, and the United States. Okay.
Usual suspects, then.
Cool. Any news? Go on.
I've got a China. Yeah, funny you say that. Any news? Because there's a China thing that I wanted to mention, actually. Yeah. It's a bit of a conspiracy theory, but one that may well be true. So, Plus Token, you probably haven't heard of.
No.
But it's a massive Ponzi scheme in China, well, across the whole of Asia, but particularly centered on China, where they fleeced unwitting customers out of roughly $3 billion. And this scam, it's one of those things that you'll probably have heard of. OneCoin.
Have you listened to that?
I haven't yet. No,
have a listen, because a friend of mine have recommended it, and I listened to it, and I really got into it. But it's only 7 episodes, but I feel like they could have gone on, and I feel like they haven't quite got to the end of. But
well,
OneCoin,
the
money they're earning was phenomenal.
Why I haven't listened to it is because there is. I know already that there's going to be no nice tie up at the end, because the idea is they're looking for the woman who set up this enormous worldwide Ponzi scheme, stealing tons of people's money allegedly. Yeah. And but we know that she's still on the run, that nobody's found her. So I'm kind of like, do I have to listen to hours and hours of this podcast just to get to the bit at the end, you know, the big climax where they don't find her?
But it's good. I mean, it's entertaining, though, all the way through, you know. I mean, I feel like I wanted more, that's all. But
I should give it a go.
I wanted more because I liked it. I mean, you know, well, if it was rubbish, I wouldn't want more. But it's worth listening, because you just realise they had all these pyramid sellers. They basically employed all these pyramid sellers, you know, and who had their own teams already set up to selling other stuff. And they came into this selling one coin, and they just really started raking it in. And they're talking millions. I mean, like billions. It's ridiculous. And
I wrote about OneCoin in my book, because it was already, even at the time I wrote my book, the thing had already exploded, and it was clear it was a Ponzi scheme. But amazingly, it's still going on, even though the woman who set it up on the run. It's like a kind of, once you set up a computer program running, it can run without you. And that's what OneCoin is doing. Yeah. It's like all the people, or a lot of the people who were involved with it, and new people, have just carried it on, even though it's being investigated by the authorities in practically every country in the world. Everybody knows that it's a scam, and yet somehow they're managing to find new people to inveigle in and get their money out of them.
It is nuts, isn't it? I know, it's completely nuts. And there's still an office, you know, in Bulgaria, I think it is, or Sofia, in Bulgaria. But it is like a wildfire, pretty much. It's, you know, it's like you realise, even though now the wildfire has been, you know, publicised, it's on telly, lots of people have been injured by it, houses burned down, killed, there are still people going to be caught in that fire, you know full well. And it's still going on. I can't believe it's still going on after all this publicity.
Yeah.
I didn't know about it beforehand, but it's one of the things everyone should share, because it's still going on. Anyway, what's this one? What is it?
This is called Plus Token. Yeah. So it's a similar kind of thing. At its peak, Plus Token was valued at $17 billion. And as I say, they raised about $3 billion from poor, unsuspecting people, victims, I guess you'd call them. But what's interesting to me about this Plus Token thing is that there is talk that the, you know how Bitcoin quadrupled in value earlier this year, and then ever since then it's been kind of slowly meandering downwards since about July. Well, July is the time when we know that money from the thieves, the $3 billion thieves of Plus Token, were starting to take their ill-gotten gains and distribute them on exchanges as Bitcoin. They converted their funds into Bitcoin and started to kind of sell it off, basically, to try and launder their proceeds around the world on various Bitcoin exchanges. So the theory is that perhaps the price has been pushed down slowly over the last few months because these thieves are trying to launder their ill-gotten gains. Oh, okay. And the more they sell, obviously, the more it pushes the price down.
Yeah.
Of course, the beauty of Bitcoin that people and thieves even often don't realize is that, of course, you can trace it all. It's all on the blockchain. Everybody can see the transaction. Now, you might not know who the people are behind the transactions, which is how, you know, you've got criminals on the run and that kind of thing. Those six team members are currently under arrest. Yeah. But the point is that because you can see where the transactions go, you can kind of start to get a feel for where the money is going, how it's being distributed, and eventually police are often able to trace it back to the people themselves, and then they can prosecute, and they've got a good case because there's so much evidence on the blockchain itself.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, that recently, I think it was Australia or someone said this, it attracts thieves and criminals, and they go, hang on a sec, there's always been thieves and criminals around, and they've often used cash. And cash was never traceable, you know? And they've
Cash is laundering. So much better.
I know.
Bitcoin, you can see where it's going. You can see what addresses it's going from and to. You can see how much is being transferred. With cash, you don't have any of those problems.
Stick to suitcases of cash, Justin. Yeah, exactly. Wasn't that pedophilia ring traceable because of Bitcoin transfers and all that stuff?
Yes, lots of paedophile rings have been broken up in exactly that way. It's amazing how criminals, you know, when a new technology comes along, it's like they get so excited that they forget about, and not just the criminals themselves, but of course the subscribers to these sites and these rings. You'll remember there was a massive operation in the early 2000s to catch paedophiles all over Britain, and in fact all over the world, but a lot of them were in Britain, and they'd all just been giving their credit card details to this paedophile website. So it was so easy to trace back because they'd given their credit card details. But of course, because in the early days of the internet, everybody thought, oh, the internet's so mysterious, it's so anonymous, they somehow thought that giving their credit card details to this anonymous site based somewhere in the world would be safe. But of course, once you track down, the police in whatever country it was track those people down, then they've got all the credit card details.
Yeah, it's phenomenal how it's sort of Luddites, you want to point at any technology advance as the reason, you know. There's been criminals around as long as been humans around, and they will use what they can at their disposal, you know. And in fact, as we get more technologically aware, like you say, there's better ways of tracing them. So I think technology is the answer, but anything that's powerful will be used and misused, you know, either way. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Oh yes. Do you know what? There's never any bank robbers around before the internet, or there's never any people ripping people off before the internet. Well, you watch it, you know, as far back as you can remember, people have been ripping people off, full stop, you know. So there we are.
Well, it will never end. It's just a constant fight. Us, the good guys against them, the baddies.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else, Glenn?
Those are the main stories that I wanted to cover today, Justin.
Well, you know what? Yesterday was 190 days away from the halving.
Your halving.
Yeah.
People ask me constantly about this halving. Every time I do a talk or something like that, everybody's like, "Well,
Bitcoin's going to be halving.
That's going to be good for the price, hasn't it?" And I say, "Well, maybe." And they always come back and say, "But it's always been good for the price in the past."
Yes.
But there's only been a handful of halvings.
Three things, less than a handful. So three things you should say.
Less than a handful, exactly.
Three things you should say to them, right? So first of all, last two halvings have been very good for the price. We can't guarantee it's going to happen in the future. What I would say is this.
Hasn't necessarily been good for the price. Maybe it was a coincidence. That's what I'm saying. When you've got not exactly a great statistical sample that there have been a couple of halvings and every time the price has happened to be rising at the same time.
It's the best performing asset in the last decade. So, you know.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying the price may have been rising anyway and it just happened to coincide with one of these halvings.
Yes, it's high probability.
There hasn't been many.
Yeah, but the chance of that happening. I mean, the gains have been phenomenal in the 6 months and 12 months after. sector have been excellent gains, phenomenal gains. And the fact there's a milestone, I invest in small cap stocks where it's all about news. When you get massive milestones approaching, people get excited, especially a countdown like this. People get really excited.
That's true. Maybe it's self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
About it and saying, so, yes. Isn't this good for
Glenn,
the price?
Go with it. Don't be a cynic. Go with it. To say, you're absolutely right. Do you know what? It's going to be bonkers. Strap in. Get your Bitcoins now, because there won't be any Bitcoin around left after the halving. So that's what you should say. But I'd say this. There's a good chance it will rise. The last twice it's happened, this time, I think it's more significant. One, because now inflation rate of Bitcoin will go below central bank's target. That means pretty much, and two, institutional investors have never been involved at this level before. There wasn't any, futures options things. There wasn't any sort of, ETFs or anything like that. And there are now in Canada. There's lots of... So institutional interest is higher than ever before. That means big money are involved and the inflation rate is going down below central bank's targets. And add to that the fact that, like you say, traditionally, twice has happened. It's done very well. So put those together. It may not happen. You never know. But do you know what? I'm betting it's going to go up. But from
it
6 months,
augurs well, I have to admit.
From 6 months to 12 months afterwards. And what I like about that, it's not just selling on the event. You have to hold, And that's investing rather than just trading then, okay? Now, I know that's an antithesis. You can't spot talking about investing. But you've got to hold it, Glenn. You've got to be patient and hold it.
I've held things for years in the past, but when I say years,
I don't know your private life.
Not like 20 years.
Okay. It's a family
show. And don't bring up Amazon, because that's the only example anybody ever has. It's like, hey, if you'd held Amazon for 20 years, you'd be rich now. Yeah, but you wouldn't have just held Amazon. Let's say you had 10 stocks, 10 tech stocks that you loved, or even 5, and you'd held them all. Yeah. You might have made lots of money on Amazon, but you might have lost all your money on the other four, because you can't just focus on Amazon. You've got to remember that there were a lot of other would-be Amazons.
Hang on, but in that example, you still made a mint. If you'd put, like, say, $1,000 in each one, 5 company tech stocks, right, from the start, and one of those had been Amazon, you'd have still been laughing your head off. Doesn't matter. If if 4 other of those companies gone bust, you lost $4,000.
All right, well, how about
this? And Amazon, you're a multi-millionaire.
Five gonna-beat-the-world type tech companies, but that didn't include Amazon. Well, if the five... Well,
yeah, I know that's the case. Yeah,
20 years ago, there was a damn good chance that, or even 15 years ago, that whatever 5 you invested in, they might not be Amazon. No. So you might have ended up with 5 worthless stocks. So I guess what I'm saying is, buy and hold is all well and good when you look back on it with hindsight and go, look how much money you could have made, but there are so many that would have disappointed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And only a handful
I think that along the way, there's certain signs that you think, okay, that's... And regardless of the share price, what that Mark Yuska was saying, I mean, let's be honest, if you pick any of the best performing tech stocks over the last 20 years, you could add that, you could use that example. It doesn't matter. He's just picking a stellar performer. I mean, anyone who'd have Amazon, have done well. But I think what it is saying is, there were times when, Amazon was getting traction, but the share price didn't reflect that. It was sold off massively at certain points where, with Bitcoin, it's getting traction. I completely, like I said, may have confirmation bias, but I'm reading news every day about countries adopting, cryptocurrencies and also using Bitcoin or things happening with Bitcoin, like investment, money inflow going in from institutions. So I'm reading about this adoption all the time. Now, the price of Bitcoin may have a big sell-off and not reflect that traction. That happens with stocks. So sometimes you've just got to keep the faith. Like Amazon is right. How many people sold out of Amazon? When actual fact, all their metrics were probably improving, but the share price had sold off for some reason, general sentiment in the market or, a recession, and people had just bailed. And in fact, what you should have done is topped up. So sometimes, like I say, you got to keep the faith when the metrics are going in the right direction. Just have a bit of faith.
You've got to have faith, the faith. Yeah, as somebody dead once said.
In fact, he's got a Christmas. It's looking like a rubbish Christmas film out called Last Christmas, based on the soundtrack of George Michael, came out this year with Emma Thompson.
I'm shivering just at the thought of it.
I'd avoid it. It looks dreadful. It looks like
with
a
Emma Thompson too.
A real poor ripoff of her doing an Eastern European accent, and it's like a poor ripoff of Love Actually and all that stuff. But it's based on George Michael's and Wham's. And they want to make Last Christmas number one hit this year, because I don't know what.
I do have a soft spot for that song though, so I wouldn't be too sad if it was a Christmas number one.
Marvellous.
It's better than most Christmas.
On that note, we managed to get Christmas into it. That's good. Glenn, we'll speak to you next week.
I look forward to it. Speak then.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Hurricane Energy, HUR. At four, i3 Energy, i3E. What's Hurricane doing? Up close to 4%, 43.4 pence. At four, i3 Energy, like I said, down a smidge, less than half of 1% at 34.65 pence. At three, S4 Capital, 15.65 pence, non-mover. At two, Innova Derma, it's 63 pence, down 0.8%, 0.8 of 1%. And at one, Keffi Minerals, up 11.11% to 1.2 pence. Top five most liked RNSs came from the following companies. At five, Mineral and Financial Investment Update. At four, Savannah Petroleum. Seven, Energy Transaction Update. At three, i3 Energy, Liberator A2 Spud and Funding Update. At two, Bluebird Merchant Ventures, Gabong Permit Received. And number one, Unijack All, Wrestle Public Inquiry Concluded. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.